The starting point is the title, are world unity and cultural diversity compatible? And obviously each of the speakers so far this weekend have had difficulty in knowing to what extent they should assume that the audience knows what we mean by a United Socialist World. Some have assumed that those sitting here know what we mean by it, others have assumed not. Looking around me, I suppose I would be safe in assuming that those that I see are in agreement with what we mean, or at least clear what we mean by a socialist world which is united on a world scale and which is not divided by frontiers as they exist now. But I would stress that anyway, that the world we are talking about is a world resulting from the conscious action of workers throughout the world to bring about a socialist society which is world in scale and not divided by national frontiers, nor in which would assumptions of national differences have survived. It's been stressed by other contributors that our starting point has to be the world as it is now, with its prejudices, with its divisions, with its illusions, with its mistaken assumptions. But of course, though where our starting point is the world as it is now, the starting point of socialism is not the world as it is now. And that led some contributors in earlier discussions to, I would say, mistaken conclusions, because they had, some of the contributors at least, assumed that socialism could be brought into being whilst a number of the attitudes and divisions that we know of today were still in existence. And Comrade Hardy laid some emphasis on the fact that no, we cannot envisage socialism being meaningful and being started without there previously having taken place a major transformation in people's attitudes, values, and thinking on the basis of which they would then introduce socialism. But taking the world that we now face, the world in which we as socialists, propagandists, as workers organizing for a different way of life, taking the world which we now are in and face, one thing immediately comes to light, which has been posed, in my experience, by critics of our view as a contradiction in our point of view, and that is the contradictory or seemingly contradictory trend in capitalism for both greater uniformity on the one hand and with the experience of nationalism over the last 140 years, the breaking down on the other hand of larger areas into smaller and smaller nation states. And that's been suggested, at least to me in the past, as being a contradiction. But I will contend that whilst an important feature, which I shall go into in some detail, of the right, in connection with the rise of capitalism, has been the rise of modern nationalism. And this has had as a consequence the breakdown of many larger former empires and the setting up of nation states. At the same time, that process has been connected with the increasing development and concentration of world capitalism, and that world capitalism as a system and the tendency for that system to make for greater and greater world uniformity has continued at the same time. So that you've had, as I say, a seeming contradiction on the one hand of the setting up of a greater number of great nation states, and on the other hand, the greater and greater consolidation of capitalism, which in many important features, which I'll touch upon later, are leading to greater and greater cultural uniformity. Now, I have taken certain aspects of what can be read into the world of the word cultural. I haven't done so with any particular authority. I'm sure there are many aspects that I will have overlooked, but since we're speaking of the compatibility of cultural diversity with socialism as we understand it will be, obviously there is some onus on me to say what sort of things I'm talking about, what I mean by cultural variance. And I've noted down there's no special significance in their order, or they're certainly not in their degree of importance, these aspects: tribe, language, religion, cuisine, dress, music and dance, sport, family patterns and structures, and democratic or degree of democratic and or despotic background. Now, I'm quite sure that any trained anthropologist, which I'm not, would devise other classifications, but these struck me as ones that were significant and certainly are variables that we must consider. It's essential for us in any discussion of this kind, having for the purposes of this meeting established those as at least among the significant cultural variants, to consider how many of those would or could carry forward into the socialist future. Clearly, a number of these factors are eliminated or considerably changed long before the question of socialism even arises, and others would, by the definition I gave earlier on, make it not possible to enter into socialism unless people themselves had made considerable changes beforehand. So that whilst there is nothing I would suggest about the nature of socialism which would lay down a priori the kind of music that we enjoy playing, or the kind of cuisine that we adhere to, or the kind of sporting activities we prefer, it's quite clear that the factor I mentioned of religion is something which, in the process of workers reaching the necessary level of understanding to make socialism a practical possibility, that is a factor which, becoming socialist, will mean people will have had to free themselves from. Well, I must say, I found it a very interesting experience some years ago when I had the honour of representing our party at the conference of our comrades in Ireland, in Belfast. It was rather fascinating to me, I must admit, to see how easily you could tell who the ex-Catholic comrades and the ex-Protestant comrades were. I tell you this, we don't have any Catholics and we don't have any Protestants in our party. But it was, as I say, fascinating to see how you could most definitely tell, in a significant number of cases, who the ex-Catholics, who the ex-Protestants were. They were obviously, therefore, shaped to a considerable extent, consciously and unconsciously, by the different backgrounds in which they had grown up. But coming back, taking these items single. I would say in relation to tribe that fairly definitely capitalism is rapidly demolishing that particular basis of human differentiation long before socialism is practically on the agenda. Right now this is happening and has been happening for a considerable amount of time. But it's worth dwelling on it if only because modern African nationalism, if it has nothing else in common, one thing every African nationalist is passionately agreed on is the opposition to tribalism and the necessity to eliminate it. Now, it's very interesting because modern African nationalism is very much an heir to the state frontiers grabbed, set up because of what the European powers in the great scramble of Africa at the end of the 19th century were able to grab. And I mean grab. It was very often literally a question of whether French forces marching out of a point in what would now be Algeria, and the British forces marching out of Khartoum, the speed or otherwise and the hazards they encountered on the way well affected whether the present frontier between what is Sudan and what is Algeria, how they were determined was the speed at which their particular troops could march. That's how arbitrary the frontiers are between almost every African state. Nevertheless, African nationalists are united, as I say, on nothing else, on the inviolability of the colonial frontiers and the unacceptability of tribalism. Well, oddly enough, precisely because a tribal society is an aspect of not merely a pre-capitalist, but a pre-feudal and pre-slave society, it has, curiously enough, certain aspects and features which have considerable attractiveness and relevance to a socialist in the way that nationalism and the build-up of modern capitalist societies most certainly does not. And it's interesting that it's precisely that surviving feature, if you like, of primitive communism that is so passionately opposed by the African nationalist movements who like to see themselves in such a progressive and radical manner. For example, I believe a former active speaker for our party, Tony Turner, who, I think to use his phrase, or perhaps it was my dad's, spent many dinnerless dinner times in the 1930s knocking around with Jomo Kenyatta, who was in those days trying to hang around the Hyde Park meetings. He learned from Kenyatta the very interesting point, which later on he was to write in a major study he made of Kikuyu tribal society, that there were features in Kikuyu tribal society which the socialists would very readily recognize, but which were lost in the process of the introduction of capitalism there. The fact that when the British colonial official first arrived on the scene, he said something to the effect of, "Take me to your leader." And of course they didn't actually have a leader to take him to, but these funny pale-faced individuals who come along with, I don't know where they came along with their funny hats with the feathers on and so on, or whether they developed those later, but they say, "Take me to leader." And who did they take him to? Well, in the tribal structure that the Kikuyus at least had, they had a division of functions on a practical level, and they had somebody who was good at talking. In a hunting and fishing society, talking wasn't a very important or significant attribute, but it was an attribute, and they did have one or other people who were rather good at talking, and so when they did have talking to be done and negotiating at times with neighbours and so on, they had a talking man. Because I imagine the spearsmen and the crack shots or archers were in a hunting society have had a rather greater significance. But take me to your leader. Better put him in touch with the talking man, because he was the only bloke who could cope with this funny fellow from the outside. And he was elevated by the colonial structure into a tribal chief, which that particular tribe and many others didn't in fact have. So one must always be on the lookout, by the way, for the conscious or unconscious imposition on earlier structures of the attitudes and values of the newly dominant structure. But as I say, whilst tribalism isn't going to be a question, a problem of the extent to which it does or it doesn't enter into a socialist future, because capitalism is answering so rapidly the question for us that it's of academic interest only. It's worth bearing in mind that in our own lifetimes we do actually see survivals of tribalism, and it's worth noting that however radical the African nationalist spokesman is on this one feature, which has negative aspects obviously, but it has these positive overhangs from what Marx would have called primitive communism, and they're again it. But that isn't, as I say, a too significant question that would carry over as to what extent it would survive. And clearly it won't survive, and that's it. But on the question of language, there we have something so deep and so fundamental in human experience that clearly it is a factor which, a very fundamental factor that has to be taken into consideration. Now, it must be stressed that none of the world's existing nation states and frontiers conform to the actual pattern of what people speak. Of all the reasons put forward or proposed for setting up a nation state, I suppose the strongest single one has tended to be the fact that everybody in a given area speaks a particular language. But in fact, I don't know of any single state that has been set up on the claim that that is the basis of it being set up, where in fact the frontiers conform to actual patterns of language. Although this has been a very cruel and hurtful and painful process, there are a number of instances where the facts have been adjusted to fit in with the theory. So that, for example, when Poland was given after the Allied victory over Germany in the Second World War, when Russia took back large areas of what had been pre-war Poland and reincorporated them into the Russian state, and in compensation, and also to weaken Germany, awarded Poland what are called the Eastern Territories, what had been Pomerania and Silesia of pre-war Germany, and those had become part of Poland, to make the facts fit in with the national theory, 2 million German speakers were physically deported there and then out of the area, and of course many others had fled beforehand. So in other words, the Polishness, the fact that everybody, or at least the overwhelming majority of people in what was Breslau and is now Wroclaw, and in what was Stettin and is now Szczecin, now speak Polish, is only because with the hideous deficiency of the modern state, millions of people were thrown out, removed, to make the Polishness conform to the Polish nationalist ideology, which would say that, you know, we're all Polish, we all speak Polish, and so if there happen to be a couple of million people around who don't, you don't adjust the theory in any way. You put them on trains or cattle trucks or whatever it is and move them out. Probably, I'll try and be brief, I noted, or perhaps getting bogged down in some of the detail, but in
And yet it is obviously very relevant to specific problems. We're talking about specific realities and their relationship with a socialist future. In looking at this question of language and the extent to which it conforms or doesn't conform to national entities, quite arbitrarily, going from left to right, I'll deal with some practical instances and see what relevance they have. In Latin America, it's called Latin America because it was conquered by the Spanish and the Portuguese, who spoke languages which derived from Latin. But it's worth remembering that whilst Spain and Portugal ruled it, Spain ruling all that, and Portugal ruling that, Brazil, they were empires, they were part of Spain, the Spanish Empire, the Portuguese Empire, and the rulers and the officials and the government used those two languages respectively. And it wasn't a question of what the peasants of Peru or Paraguay or Colombia spoke. I mean, who were they in the order of things? And even when Spanish Empire structure was breaking and Portuguese Empire structure was breaking down, and the influence of the French revolutionary ideas 1789 here, and of the American Revolution and its breakaway from England at the same period, that those major events had a big impact on Latin America, but the impact was largely on the what they call the criollo, the local elite, which was of the Spanish and Portuguese colonial elite and those who'd acquired the land and so on, who had to some extent intermarried with local people, but who were in language and religion and so on shaped and deriving from Spain and Portugal. And it was those, to use a very modern analogy, those white settlers who, long before the question ever arose in Rhodesia, were in a sense declaring, was it unilateral, unilateral declaration of independence. In a sense, that was what happened in Latin America, because unlike the American War of Independence, where there was a very important level of economic development which was connected with their desire to break from the restrictions of control from England, which was such an important factor in the American independence, and which was followed on by the ever-increasing scale of development that we associate with America once it was independent. In Latin America, that process didn't really happen, and their declaration of independence wasn't so much a reflection of the degree of economic activity and development there was, but was, as I say, more similar in a sense to the later situation in Rhodesia. But the fact is that we see it on the map, and we think of it as these countries which are Spanish-speaking or Portuguese-speaking. That totally overlooks the fact that certainly in Paraguay, certainly in Peru, to an important extent in Ecuador, Colombia, and so on, the majority of the population are still essentially the Indian population which existed there at the time of conquest, and speak Indian languages, which none of their education systems until very recently indeed even recognized or dealt with. It's worth bearing in mind in that sense that the frontiers that exist, the main divide was a line of the Pope. There was a quarrel between colonial Spain and colonial Portugal as to which part of the South America they could grab, and the Pope, as they were both Catholics, was brought in to adjudicate, and the maps were less precise in those days, and he drew a line down here, and he said, that side's yours, that side's yours. And so that side's Brazil, that's Portuguese, that side's the Spanish, you think. But the frontiers, sub-frontiers, were the Spanish colonial administrative regions. Pretty arbitrary, on practical levels, designed from the time that it would take for a ship to get out from Spain and how long it would take to refuel or restock with victuals or whatever. Not refuel at that stage, but restock with victuals on the sailing time down the coast and so on. So those frontiers were Spanish administrative frontiers, but they of course became, on independence, the frontiers of the states of South America. It's true that their grand liberator, called Simon Bolivar, did have thoughts, influenced as he was by the struggle in the United States, of a United States of South of Latin America. There were attempts both in Central America and in South America to make a greater unity, but precisely because the actual level of economic development was so much less, that soon fell through, and you had local squires or local powerful landlords, local caudillos, landowners, who set up these small areas. You would be amazed how intense the modern nationalism is of a Peruvian nationalism or of an Argentine, well, you're less amazed in the Argentine one because you've seen a little of that lately. By the way, coming, Conway gave me a lift in the this morning to get here. As I was waiting for him, timed as if to give me a Sunday morning pleasure, a great big police escort comes by, and one of those lorries comes by carrying an Argentine captured aircraft, presumably going up to the Hendon Museum. But it was a reminder of just how intense this nationalist ideology can be, although in terms of cultural difference, it's utterly meaningless. Anybody who is educated, there's no education in certainly in Argentina or Chile in anything other than Spanish, and the Indian languages where they do exist are totally unrecognized and unprovided for. Anyone who is literate there and so speaks Spanish, ditto here. If you are religious, the vast majority of people are Catholics in Argentina, in Chile, ditto Uruguay. As you go further north, Paraguay, Bolivia, and so on, it's true that the official language everywhere is Spanish, but you get very significant proportions of people who speak Indian languages. They are virtually unrecognized, though in recent years they've to some extent been considered. This is also true of Central America. So all I'm saying, therefore, on this area is that none of these frontiers accords with a cultural difference. They are all survivals of the arbitrary administrative areas of the Spanish colonial period, that the people with it, who have gone through a schooling, were educated over all this area, speak the same Spanish language. There are differences, but such slight differences that have no significance. And insofar as in these areas there are any large number of people who still speak the original indigenous Indian languages, the frontiers in no way accord to those Indian languages. So in other words, the Indian language which is spoken in this part of Paraguay is also spoken in Bolivia. The Indian languages spoken in this part of Peru extend to Ecuador and down to this part of Bolivia as well. So the frontiers don't accord with language, they don't accord with religion, they're arbitrary, but for the successor ruling classes who are attempting with greater or lesser success to build modern capitalist societies, they have no cultural significance whatsoever. I only refer to the United States to say that it was described as the great melting pot because it was famous for, with its important economic development that I mentioned earlier on, for it to be the great magnet for the dispossessed of Europe seeking prosperity and a new life and so on. That's at least what they were seeking. And from all these different parts of Europe, they went to the United States, and in theory at least, they became a melting pot. It is worth remembering, however, they weren't melted as smoothly as it was sometimes suggested or thought. And one shouldn't overlook, I won't go into any detail about it, the interesting relationship there was between the immigrant working class communities of the United States and the rise of European nationalism in the late 19th century and early part of this century. Very often they only discovered how Romanian or how Finnish they were when they went to the American melting pot. You couldn't begin to understand the Finnish independence movement, for example, without studying the American communities of lumberjacks and ship workers and so on in America, from Finland. In the case of Canada, where you're well familiar with the fact that this region of Canada, Quebec, is different. They speak French, and you've had a modern nationalist movement where workers have been persuaded the sort of problems they had result from the fact that they don't control their own affairs, and that Quebec, which is French-speaking, is merely a part of Canada as a whole, which outnumbers the French speakers. But it's worth bearing in mind, even in that respect, that not everybody in Quebec by any means speaks French, and not all the French speakers are confined to Quebec. There are lesser proportions of French speakers in all the other Canadian provinces. Some, of course, are a very small proportion, but some, it's a lesser proportion, which is quite significant. Another interesting thing which has flowed from the French-speaking demands in Quebec is that all sorts of other minorities, which in the American situation would have, in actuality or theory at least, have gone into the melting pot, have said, well, if the French speakers could, you know, have the right to have arrangements to have their kids educated in French and so on, what about we Ukrainian speakers, of whom, in this part of Canada, is a very, very major proportion, numbers away from Russia in general, but Ukraine in particular, and settled in Canada, were very significant. But it's also significant that the demands of the French speakers in French Canada has had a reflection in the other minorities there. So one interesting feature of Canada is that more than any other American country in the world, I would think, the minorities that went there have facilities for retaining their old mother tongues. Touching on Africa and some of the problems and contradictions relevant to there, I've mentioned the question of, touched on very briefly on the question of tribalism, but it's worth bearing in mind that this part of Africa, north of here, all this part here, is the part that was came under the sway of Islam, of the religion of Muhammad, and its divisions reflect, like the divisions of everywhere else in Africa, essentially what the major European powers at the end of the 19th century could grab. And the fact that this is a French, was taken over by the French, and this was taken over by the Italians, and this effectively was taken over by the British, and this certainly was British, and so on. It was arbitrary. It ran across language areas, it ran across tribal areas. It was commercial and arbitrary and practical as to which one's got which. One of the current problems is still alive is that, for example, if you want to make a telephone call from Lagos to, let's say, Abidjan in the Ivory Coast, two major commercial centres and ports in West Africa, to this day, your telephone call from Lagos to Abidjan goes from Lagos to London, London to Paris, Paris to Abidjan. They're next door to each other. It's a reminder of the extent to which their economies were fitted in with the colonial purposes for which they were taken over in the first place, which was to get the plant the cocoa and market that, to have outlets for the textiles that were being sent from Lille and Manchester and so on. The purposes of colonizing were very, very commercial, but the effects are in this kind of development are still very, very conspicuous. the language areas and tribal areas, as I say, aren't reflected by the frontiers. So you're familiar with the fact that Nigeria is the largest, not in area, but the largest population of any African state. And you've got the odd situation where linguistically the people in the area near to Lagos, well, obviously Lagos itself is a capital and so on, it brings in people from the whole area, but the people in that area of Nigeria speak the same language as the people in what on this map is called Benin, because that's the new name, but perhaps you... By the way, it's the Revolutionary Marxist People's Republic of Benin, but I think it was Dahomey. So the people in this part of Nigeria, a very important part, where the capital is, Lagos, and the people in Benin speak the same language. But the people in this vast area of northern Nigeria speak Hausa, which is quite a different language, with a strong Arab influence. And the people in this southeastern part of Nigeria felt sufficiently different from the others to give support to the struggle a few years ago, if you remember, for the breakaway of Biafra. Now, as I mentioned, the one thing that African nationalist movements, which were a further development, a logical consequence of the impact of capitalism brought by the European powers in colonializing Africa, that set in train a process of development which brought into being an elite who saw themselves as wanting to take control and further develop locally controlled capitalism. The one thing that the nationalist movements of these various countries had in common, as I stressed, was the inviolability of the arbitrary previous colonial frontiers, because nevertheless they gave them a practical reality over which they could assert control. The fact that the Biafrans were claiming that within a previous state of Nigeria, they could set up a state which had in common, they claimed, tribal and linguistic features, was a threat to all African nationalism. And one of the things that Nigeria, central government in Nigeria, had to its advantage was the almost universal support of all the other African countries in thinking this must be put down, because if this had been successful in West Africa, it would have put at risk the state structure of every one of these colonial powers. In Asia, there are two points I would particularly want to stress. The fact that, in a sense, the only two empires in the world that still survive are the Chinese and the Russian, which is a bit ironical since they both claim to be the home of revolutionary socialism and Marxism. But the only kind of empire, which Britain had a great one, France had a great one, Italy had something of one, Belgium had something of one, the only survivor of that type of empire are China and Russia. And the fact that this great chunk on the map is not very clear to you, because I don't frequent pornographic bookshops, and I feel that's where you would have to get political maps. I like these maps that show facts rather than illusions and ugly realities. But on the other hand, it doesn't make it very clear necessarily. But the point is that the map which shows, there is a faint line here which shows the extent of China, and a faint line which shows the extent of the Russian Empire. It's very important to bear in mind that though the Russians are to be found here, this is Russia on the map. And though the Chinese are somewhat more largely spread over the area that we think of as China, this is essentially where the Chinese are, but this is China on the map. And the people on both sides of those frontiers between the Russian Empire and the Chinese Empire are neither Russians nor Chinese. But on both sides of the frontier here, they're Mongolians. Both sides of the frontier here, they're various kinds of Turks and Persians. In rounding off this sort of very brief survey of the outside world, I will mention, because it's got a relevance, I feel, to aspects of the practical operation of a socialist society, the situation of India. Modern nationalism certainly had its impact on India, but you will remember, you'll be reminded of it no doubt when you see the film Gandhi, as I suppose you'll have to sooner or later, that the hallmark of Indian nationalism, again, was the stress upon the arbitrarily arrived at imperial frontiers. Now, India is referred to as a subcontinent. It's got an incredible range of languages, religions, history, which covered different empires, covering up different parts of it, and so on. And what it certainly had in common, and the Congress movement was very attached to maintaining that continuity, was the fact that these particular spots were red on the map. They had been part of the British Empire. The great criticism that the Indian Congress movement and Nehru made of Jinnah was that he broke up the unity of the Congress movement for national independence on the lines of the British imperial area as a whole, unified, by suggesting that what was needed, as far as the Muslims were concerned, was a Muslim state, which didn't cover all the imperial area of Britain, but those areas in imperial India where the Muslims were in the majority. And as you know, that view had a certain success in the sense that Pakistan did come into existence against the opposition of the Congress movement, with a vast amount of bloodshed and horror in the process of sorting out who was going to be behind the frontier and who was going to be in front of it and so on. But nevertheless, the feature remains of India that you couldn't possibly attempt, however much you wanted to as a nationalist, to set up frontiers on European lines, because people of these different groupings and religions and so on aren't identifiable in any one geographical spot in any neat and tidy way. Now, a man writing on the situation in India, probably India some years ago, called Edwards, put forward a suggestion. It may seem rather fanciful, but I do see something of the point, that perhaps what India needed was to avoid — he was worried at the stage about the demands to set up new states in India to conform allegedly to language areas and so on. He said perhaps what India would better have would be a modern democratized system of the Ottoman Empire. Now, in Ottoman Turkey, which was Turkey's only this area now, but until the First World War, it covered what is now Iraq and Syria and much of Arabia, and had previously included North Africa. In this Ottoman Empire, again, people were not placed, either by religion or language, in any clear-cut geographic zones. True, there were more Greeks in what is now called Greece than most other places, but by no means all the people in what is now Greece were Greeks, and Greeks were by no means confined to what is now Greece. To this day, there are Greek communities right round the coast of certainly the eastern Mediterranean, and there certainly were Greek communities right up into the Black Sea in places that are now Russia and so on. So certainly the Jews and the Armenians and so on were spread over this area. And for administrative convenience and for other reasons, the Ottoman Empire gave legal administrative structures so that many of the communities within this vast mixed amalgam of languages and religious groupings and so on had considerable administrative control over those communities, not on a geographic basis, because they were spread all over, but on a communal basis, so that Greek Orthodox, wherever they were, marriage and divorce, insofar as it existed in that period in Greek Orthodox, I'm not so sure, and such matters were under the jurisdiction of the Greek Orthodox Church. Armenians, wherever they were in these matters, were under the jurisdiction of the Armenian church structure, Jews, ditto. And it was thought, therefore, that that might have had a greater relevance, but of course modernized and democratized, than the essentially European 19th century assumption that you could sort out everybody neatly into Hungarians and French and Portuguese or what have you, and draw a neat line around them.
The points I have touched upon, I hope that they may well lead to points for discussion and so on, but their essential reason for my indicating a number of specifics is because I think that in our planning and thinking in terms of socialist society, we have to obviously make certain assessments as to the validity and worth, continuity to be applied to these differing aspects. I would submit, and like previous speakers at this conference, we're projecting our thoughts, we're looking to the future, we're not laying down, can't lay down precise formulas. As you can see, these involve 1,001 fluid situations, and depending on whether we're talking in terms of socialism, let's hope we are, in the quite near future, or whether in the longer term, things won't stop in the meanwhile, and so the situation won't be the same. It will, so much of our planning and thinking about socialism will obviously depend at what particular stage it becomes a realistic possibility and is actually brought into being. But I do think that these features, we could say, would be very relevant to socialism. I think that freed of the national frontiers, we would still think in terms of practical, smaller areas for different purposes. They won't necessarily be the same. Even now, if you look at London, London hospital administration isn't the same as London education structure. London fire services cover one area. The London administration of water supply has to think in rather larger terms. The extent of Wales, to the annoyance of Welsh nationalists at times. But you appreciate how even in capitalist terms, there are different scales of structure according to the purpose in hand. And I certainly think that the absence of national frontiers, which I stress are arbitrary and have never served any purpose of benefit or concern to the majority of people, and certainly would go immediately upon the establishment of socialism. What regions we establish would, I think, be different for different functions and purposes. There isn't some region which is naturally so. So I would say that in terms of education, schooling, clearly parents and kids themselves, we don't want to be ageist, do we? But the parents and the kids would, in wanting to educate their kids in terms of literacy and so on, would clearly have choices as to which language. In places where, you know, there are coexisting language groups, clearly people would have the option to send their kids to this language school or that language school. So in terms of the administration of education, you can certainly see patterns for administration in that sense. But in terms of rail organisation, let us say, or water supply, quite different natural areas would and could rapidly, by anyone expert and familiar in that field, show themselves. But what I would stress and submit is that I wouldn't see them as in any way coterminous. Similarly, there has been an argument for a long time. I was reminded of it in the party just recently when we were circularised with some details about some free lessons in Esperanto that the Workers' Esperanto Organisation thought our members would like to take up. One thing is certain, we as socialists, at the Socialist Society of the Future, would be very sensitive to the inequalities of opportunity and rights and free expression that capitalism has imposed upon people, and we would be specially sensitive, both in working for socialism and once we'd achieved it, to all those people who, though they may have spoken Estonian, found that the only way they could earn a living or get promotion or get a schooling was but through the medium of Russian, or those who spoke Welsh through the medium of English, or those who, etc., etc. And we are well aware, as an organisation of workers, wanting and working to collaborate with our fellow workers throughout the world in our common struggle, with the sheer practical difficulties there are in communicating with each other, especially if we happen to be workers who've grown up in England, where consciously and unconsciously we've acquired certain of the imperial attitudes of contempt and for the effort involved in learning other people's languages, because we've grown up with the assumption they've all got to speak English. And so we have to develop these sensitivities to those people who've been at the deprived end, at the hurt end of having to learn another language in order to get a job or to talk to a bus conductor or whatever the case may be. And the argument has been put forward that therefore we would have a special interest in something like Esperanto. Well, I'm inclined to agree, though I think it would have to be something like Esperanto rather than Esperanto itself, because it's worth bearing in mind that this artificially, brilliantly constructed language was the work of a 19th century Polish Jew of considerable scholarship, but who nevertheless, although very understandably, constructed this language as he saw it as a world auxiliary. Never imagined that everybody would be speaking to everybody all the time in Esperanto. But what he did see was that here was a means of easy for everybody to acquire for common interchange, which was neutral in the sense that English or Russian weren't, because they were imperial languages. Problem with Esperanto is that, of course, it is a Eurocentric language. Its design, its essential features are its Latin base. And so here was a language designed as a world neutral or auxiliary for people to communicate with each other other than in their particular local languages. But of course, its assumptions were European, and whilst I would envisage the development of a convenient, easy to learn, exception-free grammar of a language, I'm inclined to think that a language which didn't take into account the experience of 1,000 million Chinese speakers would hardly qualify as a world auxiliary language. So I throw that forward to show that even in fields like Esperanto, which where they present themselves as having a solution. Incidentally, they suggest that the cause of the problems is that people can't understand each other. Well, of course, as Britain and Ireland knows, sometimes the problems exacerbated because they do understand each other. I mean, it's not just the language problem, but clearly, the division amongst us of languages is not in itself a problem for socialism. And I round off by suggesting that this very important, valuable difference will in fact flourish. Those are thoughts which I throw forward on cultural diversity and why I think socialism can meet them, develop them, and have real possibilities outside the present ones of capitalism.